We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another great guest this morning with his toe in different waters. He is a USCF master and has done a lot in the chess world and is still fairly active discussing chess online. But he is best known these days as a cognitive scientist. He co-authored a famous study called The Invisible Gorilla, which we will talk about for a bit. He's also been doing continuous research on psychology and the brain over the past 20 years, in addition to a lot of chess stuff. So I am eager to talk to him. Christopher Chabry, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's sort of like a mini bucket list item to be on this podcast.
Well, thank you. I mean, this is small potatoes for a lot of the stuff that you've done. Your Invisible Gorilla video has 19 million YouTube views somehow. I don't even know. Like, I can't even wrap my head around that. So for listeners who don't know about it, and Chris, I know that you've been talking about this study for 20 years, so we'll try to keep it relatively short. But for listeners who don't know, Chris was the co-researcher of a study, a famous YouTube video where, well, Chris, you explain it.
So The Invisible Gorilla refers to a study that my colleague, also a chess player, incidentally, Dan Simons, and I did when Dan was a professor at Harvard and I was a graduate student just finishing up my PhD. And it concerns what people pay attention to and what people, especially what people miss when they're paying attention to something, which I think has some relevance for chess and a lot of other, you know, daily activities we engage in. So in this study, we created a video where there are six people passing two basketballs around, and three of the people are wearing white shirts and three of the people are wearing black shirts. So more chess inspiration there. And the people in white shirts pass their own ball around and the people in black shirts pass their own ball around. And when we asked people to just watch the video and count in their heads the number of times the people in white shirts passed their ball around, we found that about half the people, depending on how we set up the video and exactly which video it was, about half the people who kept track of what the white players were doing with their ball completely missed that a person in a gorilla suit walked right through the middle of the action and, in fact, stayed on the screen for 9 seconds and thumped its chest at the camera and so on before leaving. So even though the gorilla was sort of like right in the middle of all the people that the participants in the experiment were following and paying attention to, about half, completely failed to notice it. So it's a demonstration of a phenomenon called inattentional blindness, that sort of when you're not paying attention to something, even if it actually happens right in front of you, it can be just as though you're sort of blind to that thing. You have no memory of seeing it. You don't recognize it. You're surprised to hear that it was there and so on. And that's inattentional blindness. And that sort of became a famous demonstration of that effect. It's not the only one, but it's sort of the best known because it's got a campy gorilla that thumps its chest. And it really carries on the blindness for, you know, a long period of time compared to some other experiments that had been done.
Yeah. And I mentioned to you when we were emailing that I had come across this study. I've read a decent amount of books about decision making and stuff like that. So this study crossed my radar probably 5-6 years ago, and I saw the video, and I was one of the people that did not see the gorilla. Just for shits and giggles, I had my 5-year-old watch it last night, and he saw the gorilla, although somehow he didn't consider it noteworthy. He sat there and watched the video, and then when it was over, I said, "Did you see the gorilla?" And he said, "Yeah," but he didn't mention it. He was just sitting there trying to count the number of passes. So like you say, I mean, even in the case where someone sees it, they, you know, it kind of underscores that he didn't think it was funny or absurd or mention like how crazy it was that or how unusual it was to have this walk across the screen. Professor Chabris, he's written a book about this subject in 2011 and talked about it on many other podcasts and on Google Talks and stuff like that, if you search for it. So listeners, I encourage you, I'll link to the video and I encourage you guys to check it out. But I think we should stick to the chess dynamics of it. So what do you think? How does it relate to chess?
Well, I actually haven't thought about that all that much, although I did mention it myself a couple of times right now when I was describing it. But strangely enough, I was doing other research on cognitive psychology and chess at the same time that Dan and I did this project. And in fact, I was my PhD thesis for my PhD in psychology was a study of chess masters, basically expertise in chess masters. And we were just doing this gorilla study at the time, so it didn't really occur to me to sort of incorporate this directly. But we did some similar things. In one of my experiments, we looked to see what changes people would notice in famous chess positions. So there's a phenomenon related to inattentional blindness called change blindness, which is that if something changes in your visual world and sort of, you know, whatever's in front of you, but you are not paying attention at the time it changes, you might not notice that it has changed. And this can be an extravagant phenomenon, too. Like Dan and I have done experiments where you can basically replace a person with another person, and people may not notice that they're talking to someone completely different and so on. Where we tried to apply it in chess was we got diagrams of famous chess positions. And I tried to sort of find the most famous ones at the time. We did this in the late 90s. So, you know, most of them are still famous chess positions. They're, you know, ones that go back quite a ways. And we would make a diagram of the famous position. And then we would make a diagram of that position with something changed. And it could be sort of like an irrelevant change, like we moved a pawn to some other square when that doesn't have anything to do really with what's going on in the position. Or we moved something that really changed the meaning of the position, you know, that made the combination not work anymore or made the important move no longer, you know, legal or effective or something like that, and tried to see, you know, whether people noticed the changes that affected the meaning more. And in fact, they did, but they failed to notice a lot of the irrelevant changes. And we did a lot of experiments along those lines where we didn't really look at inattentional blindness, but we sort of looked at change blindness and noticing changes as a way of trying to figure out like how chess players' memory is structured and what you know, what the contents of memory for chess positions is and how that might be relevant to, you know, the process of figuring out the best move and figuring out what's going on in the position.
That's interesting. And did you have a thesis going in about how chess players would
like whether or not they would recognize the change and whether or not there would be a difference across playing strength and stuff like that?
I'm not sure exactly what my original thoughts were about this experiment, because it was a while ago. And I do know that my very first thought about this study, and I had actually done other studies on chess expertise before then, but my very first thought on this study would be that people would notice a lot of changes. And this was before I learned about this concept of change blindness and sort of how little people do notice. So at first I was just moving pawns around and so on and being surprised when people didn't notice those things. So then that sort of led me to, a deeper realization, which is that, and prediction, which was borne out, that the changes that affect the meaning, and which meaning's a bit of a nebulous concept, but I think chess players could sort of grasp it if they saw a position and they saw that, you know, there's some combination going on the king side, and it doesn't matter whether Black's a pawn is on a6 or a5. The whole combination still works, and the evaluation of position is the same. That's sort of easy to explain to chess players. It might be a little harder to convey to cognitive psychologists or something like that who don't know chess. So we did predict that they would notice the meaning changes more than the non-meaning changes, and that's what we did find. And it was really fun, like gathering up like positions that we thought people would already know, because we tested a couple of grandmasters as well, and had them just reconstruct those positions entirely out of memory. All we told them was something like Hrushevsky Petrosian, Zurich 1953, before Black plays Rook E6. I don't know if that evokes a memory for you, but for a lot of, you know, players who know that game, it's a famous example of a positional exchange sacrifice where Black plays Rook E6 and White can just take it right off with his bishop, and it's just a rook for a bishop, but it gives Black a total grip on the white squares, and that determines the outcome of the game. And in fact, we found that grandmasters, you know, could pretty much set that position up right, but the few mistakes they did make were things that didn't affect, you know, whether the exchange sacrifice worked and whether it was the best move and so on. So that was kind of a fun part of the study, to actually study some grandmasters.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, given, just my experience in talking to stronger players and you know, some of the interactions I've had with them here on Perpetual Chess. I mean, their recall and their ability to just be studying some random endgame and then compare it to, like, some other game from, like, you know, 1930 or something, it just boggles my mind. So, and
well,
of course,
the stereotype is not true, though. The stereotype is that they can remember all of it. Right.
Right.
So we did find mistakes. It's just that the mistakes almost never actually affected what the point of the, you know, of the memory was. Like, you don't remember that position to remember whether Black's, you know, whether Black's a pawn is on a6 or a7. You remember it because of something else.
Right. And that jives with the famous study. I'm blanking on who conducted it, but the one where if you generated random positions, chess masters' recall of the position was not necessarily better than if it was generated from an actual game.
It was much worse, in fact. So that study was published by William Chase and Herbert Simon. Herbert Simon was a Nobel Prize winner in economics, although he was really one of the pioneers of cognitive psychology and cognitive science. And they found that they actually had three participants, but by modern standards, it was sort of a laughably small study of human behavior by modern standards. But you know, when the effect you're looking at, you know, when the difference you're looking at is that big, sometimes you can find it with just three participants. So they had a beginner, an amateur, and a master. I think the master was actually Hans Berliner, who at the time or later won the World Correspondence Chess Championship and was a computer chess pioneer, an artificial intelligence guy, but he was also like a 2400 player, and he was their master, I think. And, you know, he was able to look at a position for 5 seconds or so on the board and then reconstruct it, you know, almost entirely correctly if it came from a regular game. But if it was randomly generated, then he would get maybe like 5 or 6 pieces right or something like that on average. That's the big, you know, that's the big difference. Whereas, you know, amateurs or beginners were sort of much worse, even with the realistic positions. They remembered much less of them and set up fewer of the pieces correctly. And we actually repeated that study too as part of our work, just, you know, almost just for fun and to see it work in person. And we have a video online of Patrick Wolf, who was U.S. champion, two-time U.S. champion at the time, you know, doing exactly those experiments and then talking about it afterwards. So that's on the same YouTube channel where the Invisible Gorilla video is.
Oh, cool. I definitely would like to check that out. And I noticed that you've done a few collaborations with Patrick Wolf.
Yeah, I've known him for a long time. He's sort of like, I don't even know if semi-retired is the right word, sort of mostly retired from active chess these days, because he's in finance and has had various roles in finance and so on. But I've known him for something like 35 years or so. We were both on Colin's kids teams in the early 1980s, I think, when Jack Collins would take a bunch of kids up to Iceland to play against Icelandic kids or Israel, or they would come here. I think I met him there, and I've worked with him on various things over the years. But happy to talk about any of those if you want.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to those. But first, I have one more question related to Invisible Gorilla. This is from a supporter of the podcast, Philip Wilson. He asks, I've seen the Gorilla Study video many times. There's always one or more person in the audience who just won't believe they're watching the same video. And I know I felt the same way the first time I saw it. And we experience something similar in chess when we move and suddenly then a veil is lifted and there your queen is hanging. What are the best practical tips or strategies you learn for checking yourself in situations like this?
Oh, what a great question. of all the questions I've ever gotten about Invisible Gorilla related stuff, I've never got that one. So kudos for that. It definitely is true that I've had that experience too, where you make a move and then suddenly you notice something, or even you notice it like as you're making the move, it's just sort of like somehow the visual disturbance of the scene in front of you, triggers some kind of process where you may then, shift your attention to something you weren't paying attention to before, or, recognize a pattern you weren't recognizing before. And I don't know if I have a great tip for avoiding that. It used to be said that you should write your move down before you make it, but that's effectively illegal now. That could help a little bit with that. But I don't know that there are any sort of, very practical, thinking tips, except trying to build the habit of, doing sort of like a final blunder check, perhaps I guess if I had to make something up on the spot, without doing any research on it, I would say maybe like if it's a slow game, look away for 5 seconds, like look at the ceiling for 5 seconds and then look back and sort of do your blunder check or something like that. But even so, like the amount of residue that's built up, I'm speaking metaphorically, but the amount of residue that's built up in the mind from sort of thinking about a chess position for so long, it's hard to just wipe that out, and then say, oh, I'm going to look at it fresh and I'm going to see all the blunders and, so on. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, I don't think there's any sort of instant fix for that. Yeah. That's part of why chess is so hard.
Yeah, exactly. Although I do have an idea, Christopher. How about you pantomime the move before you make it? You mimic the motion of making the move without touching the piece.
Oh, you mean like you hover your hand over the piece and then?
Yeah, you just like stop, if you're going knight to f3, you stop two inches short of f3 and move your hand to f3 without actually touching the piece. Your opponent will love it.
Yeah, your opponent will hate it, first of all. And if you did that every move, I would see good grounds for a complaint under the general rule of my opponent is disturbing me during the game, right? I'm also, and if it were poker or something like that, that'd be like forward motion, I'd say that you've actually done something when you didn't think you were. It would be like angle shooting in poker or something, but I've never heard of that. I mean, I've never heard of that one. It might work. I mean, I would say like if any of these things, try it and see, try it and see what happens. Try it with a friendly opponent who's not gonna, get totally pissed off about it on that one though.
Yeah, you could at least do that online, although I don't know if it would have the same effect moving the mouse. But anyway, I'm mostly kidding. I do think it could be effective, but I think that you might get kicked out of the tournament or something, or get sent to be evaluated. So probably not worth it in the grand scheme of things. So let's dig into more of your chess stuff. So I mean, since I've gotten to know you online a little bit, I've come across all of the chess that you've been involved with, and it impresses me that for someone who's got, an active career and a, highly respected researcher, you seem more, there's other people that come to mind who made a big imprint in the chess world, like Ken Rogoff and Stuart Rachels, and I'm sure there's others, but you still seem to have your finger on the pulse of the chess world. You're active in the Facebook groups and following events and stuff. So why don't we start by just, the classic tale of how you got into chess.
Okay, great. Yeah, and unfortunately, I'm not one of the strongest professors who's a chess player because there's so many grandmasters. going back to Lasker, I guess. So I got started because in 1972, my father was watching the PBS broadcast of Fisher versus Spassky. And in my visual memory, which is probably sort of largely constructed and not realistic, he was sitting in an easy chair with an ottoman in front, and he had his chessboard and pieces set up on the ottoman, and he was literally following the moves by making them on the board as, you know, as they were broadcast on those old PBS shows with Shelby Lyman and a lot of the old New York chess guys as guest stars. And so he taught me how to play, and he knew enough about chess, and his older brother was sort of the bigger chess player in the family. And then he started like giving me chess books, and I think he gave me some copies of Chess Life that he got from a friend of his at work or something like that. And I sort of just gradually absorbed all that stuff. And this started when I was five. But back then, there was no sort of like organized scholastic chess scene the way there is now. I mean, it's amazing how much infrastructure there is now, you know, to suck interested and potentially talented kids into organized lessons and classes and tournaments and, you know, unrated tournaments. None of that really existed, at least not really near where we lived. So, you know, at some point I kind of got bored with it and had never played a tournament or went to a club, and sort of dropped out after, you know, after like 2 or 3 years. You know, I got to the point where I could beat him, you know, right. My father, you know, and so on. But that was sort of, you know, without formal instruction, and he didn't have a rating or anything like that, you know. So, and then we moved, and I happened to, by total random chance, we moved to a different town where the closest kid my age, who was a neighbor, his father happened to be a chess master and happened to give private lessons on their porch. And I was in the backyard playing baseball with my friend and saw his father giving a private lesson on their porch and walked over and started looking. And that kind of got me back into it. I wound up taking lessons from that guy. His name is Dan Samuels. He's long since, you know, inactive and older, but I mean, he was my teacher for like 7 years or so. And I went to a chess club. I started playing in tournaments. I got back to it like 5 years after I had started.
So how old were you when you got back to it?
I was 10.
Okay.
My first rating, I remember, was exactly 11-13.
You've got me beat. Mine was 9-36. I also remember.
I think I had a head start because I had actually like started like thinking about chess 5 years before I played in the tournament, which is sort of unheard of nowadays, except for sort of, I guess nowadays, if you were an adult, sort of, you know, an adult learner in that situation, you would have been playing online for 5 years or something before you went to a USCF rated tournament or a FIDE rated tournament or something like that. So you could start out much, much, much higher. So, and then it took me about 7 years from then, no, 9 years from then to actually get to master. I thought I had gotten to master after 7 years, and I was playing in the World Open that year. And I was, you know, there was no instant rating availability the way there is nowadays by email and so on. So in my last round game, a well-known chess personality, still nowadays, whose name I won't mention.
All right, now I'm excited. my ears are perking up. Go on.
I'm not going to mention his name, because what happened was, at the time I thought what happened was not that great, but maybe in retrospect it's okay. I went to, he didn't want to play the round. It was the last round. I think he was out of contention for a prize. I think he had like a really bad game the round before, something like that. He didn't want to play the round, so I went to the board and I played C4. Sorry, I played E4. I never played C4. It was a single tournament game. I played E4, and he played C5 and offered me a draw. And I didn't know what to do because I thought I was really close to making master, and I thought maybe I already was over 2,200. But it was hard to tell that day because all you could do was look at the wall chart, and all of the ratings there are just the ones that were printed in the rating supplement, which might be like 2 months stale by the time the tournament started or something like that. And so on. So I went and I spent like 10 minutes in my memory, 10 or 15 minutes in my memory, trying to calculate what my rating would be at the end of the tournament if I accepted the draw, because I really wanted to get to 2,200. And I was not in like the right mindset, which of course is I'm playing a higher rated player. You know, I've got white. I should really just play the game, try to win, you know, and use it as a learning experience. But I wanted to use it as an experience to make 2,200. So I did all these calculations and I thought, okay, I'm going to get to like 2,205 if I accept this draw. So I went back and I accepted the draw. And then I went home and I waited for like 2 months for the ratings to be updated. and it came out at 2197. And it took me two more years to get over 22.
Wow. That's funny. I guess you got what you deserved in a sense.
So the first 2 years of college are really not a good time to pump up your rating, you know, everything else is changing in your life and you can play a lot of chess, but it's really not a good time to be really focusing on getting better and lessons and all that stuff and so on. So maybe I made the wrong decision or I should have played in more tournaments that summer, you know, but I was really wanted to get to 2200. So I waited.
Yeah, I understand completely. And I had a similar origin story in chess. I think I might have mentioned it before, but the very short version is I learned to play when I was six and loved it right away. And I didn't, there's no Google, you know, there's no easy way to find out that this other world exists. So I didn't play a tournament until I was 12 either. And I definitely, you know, I liked the game right away. I would have been interested right away. I remember, you know, eagerly waiting for the rating supplement to see the rating change. And then when you got to Harvard, you managed to combine your interest in chess with a lot of your research. It seems like in fairly short order.
Well, so the research that I did was when I was working on my PhD, which was later. When I first got there for my undergraduate degree, I majored in computer science, largely because of my interest in computer chess. I think it was computer chess that really got me interested in artificial intelligence and therefore computer science. And of course, most of computer science is not computer chess. You know, it's all kinds of other things. There's a lot of math in it and so on, which, you know, in retrospect, I'm not as good at math as I really needed to be in order to be a superstar computer science student, but it did okay and sort of discovered through that there was this thing called cognitive psychology and sort of, you know, different ways of applying ideas from computer science to understanding how the mind works and how the brain works. So it's sort of, in a way, the interest in chess and computer chess sort of led me eventually into the field that I wound up pursuing. And I kind of kept coming back to chess every so often. I tried to study different things, but then I wound up doing this PhD thesis on chess masters thinking. And I would often spend time, you know, organizing chess events and, you know, doing things that didn't necessarily advance my career at the pace that it should have been advanced at. So I, you know, I would organize some events when I was an undergraduate. I ran the chess club for a while. And then I helped sort of after graduating, after I graduated, Dan Edelman, who's an international master, who was also, I think, fairly inactive now. He's also in finance now. He came to Harvard as an undergraduate and he kind of took over the chess club. And since I was working at Harvard afterwards doing research, I helped him organize a bunch of events. So we had Kasparov come and visit Harvard. And then apparently Karpov heard that Kasparov had visited Harvard. So Karpov wanted to visit Harvard too. So he came. And then we started a computers versus humans chess tournament, which was kind of fairly unique at the time. This was, you know, before the Deep Blue Kasparov matches and so on. We did a bunch of sort of chess organizing stuff at the time also.
Were you able to get money from Harvard to make those things happen? Or how did you make them happen?
Yeah, how did we pay Kasparov? Because he wasn't free back then.
Yeah, I know he's not cheap these days. And even then, I'm sure.
Honestly, I don't remember exactly where the money came from. And that's not sort of that's not referring to the idea that it came from dark sources.
Right.
The chess club at Harvard was an undergraduate group, just like any other group. And there was sort of a fund of money set aside that, you know, undergraduate groups could apply for. And I'm sure we got a couple thousand dollars from that. And we got some donations from other, sort of local people who were in chess. I believe that, Bill Roberti, who is best known as a backgammon player and the co-author of a very influential series of poker books, with Dan Harrington, also a chess player. There's incredible overlap between chess and poker and backgammon and other games. Bill Roberti, who had been a very successful games player, I think he maybe donated some money to support these events. And kind of the centerpiece of Kasparov's visit, Kasparov at the time was sort of known for the stunt of playing clock simultaneous exhibitions against strong players. So he had played the entire German national team, I believe, in a clock simultaneous. So sort of like six GMs at once, you know, and beat them, you know, 4-2 or some incredible score for another grandmaster to beat them by. So we set up an 8-board clock simul Kasparov against a bunch of other people, some strong Harvard students. And I think there was a computer in it too. I think we got some computer software company to to pony up a little bit of money so that their program could play Kasparov and get crushed. We had some public events, and a lot of, you know, people tried to interview Kasparov, and he got very upset with the press coverage that he was getting on this trip. This was 1989, by the way, when he had not really come to the U.S. very much. You know, at that point now, he basically, as far as I understand it, basically lives here. But at the time, I think he was a little bit unused to the aggressiveness of the media and the extent to which they would sort of amplify one's most controversial statements. So he'd given a Playboy interview where he said something like women can't play chess because they're not aggressive enough, or some kind of sort of, you know, stereotypical stuff. The campus reporters started asking him about that, and he got pretty mad at that, and he sort of yelled at me in public in front of everybody else at the event.
That's interesting. So you weren't the one that asked the question, but he...
I think his view was that we were the organizers. I mean, trying to put myself in his shoes, we were the organizers. We had invited him, you know, we were paying him. He was, you know, the celebrity, and it was our job to kind of manage the press.
Right, run interference.
Yeah. Understood that we can't manage the press to the extent of, like, suppressing questions.
Yeah, that's quite a story. I mean, and I will say to Kasparov's credit, he, on Twitter in the past year or so, he basically did a mea culpa for some of the comments he's made about women in chess. In his younger years, so
that's right, and I think we're all sort of deceiving ourselves if we think there's nothing we said, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, or however many years ago, that we don't regret nowadays. So I think it's, you know, it was a controversial thing when he said it, and that's probably partly why people were asking about it, and it was a legitimate thing to discuss.
Yeah, and we've all mellowed out a little bit with age, I would think, but. But so you organized these events with Kasparov. You also subsequently, you know, as you mentioned, this might have been some of your projects that you mentioned that maybe were to the detriment of your career as a research scientist. But you were the editor in chief of the short-lived American Chess Journal, and helped publish a couple chess books. So why don't you tell us about those forays into chess publishing?
Yeah, somehow I got involved in that. I'd gotten involved with the Massachusetts Chess Association when I was sort of there running the Harvard Chess Club and these events, and they published a magazine, they still do, called Chess Horizons, which at the time sort of was winning all kinds of chess journalism awards. It was sort of the best state chess magazine in the U.S., and it had like a columns by people from Europe and all kinds of stuff. It was really sort of beyond its means in a certain sense, and a friend of mine, Tim Hankey, who's a sort of like a strong expert, he had been the editor of Chess Horizons, and then I think followed him as the editor, and did that for a year or so. And it was kind of a lot of work for very little pay, but I got the idea that it would be cool to have a sort of like a scholarly journal about chess. And this is an idea that other people have had over the years. So back in the 1960s, Frank Brady had one that ran for sort of like three issues. He published in there a famous interview with Bobby Fischer, where Fischer ranked the top 10 players of all time, which is still an article well worth reading. Fischer described why he thought those players were the best and so on. As I recall, he had a very high opinion of Morphy and a low opinion of some, you know, Soviet players. I started this thing with Tim Hankey and Patrick Wolf. So two of my friends, we were sort of the co-editors. I was the head of the triumvirate. And the idea was to publish really sort of like scholarly or at least literary articles about chess. It was kind of inspired by literary journals and scholarly journals. And we sold subscriptions and we raised some outside funds. And I think we published a lot of really good articles and we won a bunch of chess journalism awards at the time. I don't know how many, I never counted. It was, you know, as a business, it was not successful. You know, we were doing a lot of work and not making enough money with it. And none of us were doing it full time, which is always a sort of bad recipe for having a, you know, long-term sustainable, you know, business, I guess. And so we only ever got out three issues, and then we refunded the money of the subscribers when we couldn't, you know, we sort of couldn't get the fourth issue out. But I recently had all the pages scanned and put all the issues online, and also all the two books that we published, which were Patrick Wolf's book about the Kasparov-Anand World Championship match in 1995, played at the top of the World Trade Center. 6 years before it was destroyed, which I still think is one of the really the best, one of the best matchbooks ever published. I mean, it was definitely the best book on that match because it was written by Anand's, one of Anand's seconds. And Patrick went into great detail in the analysis, and that was a great book. And we also published a book on the Kasparov Deep Blue match in 1997, the one that the Deep Blue won by 3.5, 2.5, which is written by David Goodman and others. And that's online too. People can check that. And I still think that's a pretty good book. So we didn't do much, but I think what we did was fairly high quality and still has stuff that's worth looking at.
Yeah. And I'll put a link to where you guys can find that stuff online. And I do recommend checking it out. And of course, you know, 25 years later, I commend you for the effort. we all know that these chess side projects, they often are not financially remunerative, but people really enjoy them. So.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I mean, one thing that happened as a result of that was we published lots of book reviews because I like chess books. I like book reviews. I've written a lot of book reviews myself, both of chess and non-chess books. And we had a column in the American Chess Journal where we sort of gave like a one sentence review of every book we got, as well as we gave much longer reviews of some books. So we wrote these little one sentence reviews. And as a result, partly as a result, all the chess book publishers would send us all of their books. So, you know, somehow my book collection ballooned, you know, with every book that was being published in the period, you know, 1993 to 1996 or something like that.
That explains how you have 1,060 chess books, as you were telling me before we started recording.
And no, if I kept every book I ever had, I would have like, you know, 1,600 or 1,700 or something like that, because I'm sure I've gotten rid of at least 500 or 600 in various ways over the years.
That's funny. And speaking of the book reviews, I did check out the first issue that you have posted online, and you had a review of Kathy Forbes' biography of the Polgars. And we don't need to go too deep into that individual book, but it does touch on a topic that I think you're particularly well qualified to talk about, which is the role of talent in chess, something that's come up periodically here on the podcast. But I'm curious to hear from your experience and from your research how important you think it is to one attaining different levels in chess skill.
That's a really good question, and it can sprout off in all kinds of directions. But I guess I guess one thing I can say is that the so-called, I mean, the Polgar sisters, obviously remarkable players, remarkable people, you know, have done a lot for chess, you know, and so on, and I love them. But I think the so-called Polgar experiment doesn't really show that much of sort of scientific interest, even though people sometimes use it to say, you know, look, they, you know, they trained from an early age in chess, their father taught them, you know, and so on, and they became great, therefore anyone can learn anything, you know, if they work hard enough on it. They could have had, you know, they could have had the right talent to start with, and the three sisters had different outcomes, right, in terms of skill levels reached in the end, and so on. So it doesn't really show that much, but there is a scientific literature about this where people have looked at factors that correlate with, you know, with chess success. And, you know, it turns out that, you know, I mean, maybe this is not going to be surprising, but it might be controversial some places. Being smart to start with helps you become good at chess, just like it sort of helps you succeed in any area, you know, and chess is a fairly analytical, thinking intensive, calculating, you know, a memory intensive, you know, game. So, or pastime, you know, or activity. So it sort of stands to reason that if you, you know, if you start out with, you know, a lot of mental ability, you're going to, you know, learn faster and so on. But at the same time, how much effort you put in and what kind of effort you put in is obviously, you know, very important as well. So, from the individual's point of view, you can't change sort of your, you know, you can't change what you bring to the project of learning and succeeding at chess, but you can, you know, optimize or at least, you know, improve your study methods, your training methods, your sleep habits, your nutrition, you know, all that stuff. And there are very specific and good strategies, you know, that are well studied in psychology for improving your learning, which should apply to chess just as much as to anything else.
So could you share a few of them in more detail? I mean, I don't think they're going to shock our listeners, but still, it'd be good to hear them from a source as well steeped in the literature as you are?
Oh, well, so there's this field called the science of learning, which is largely based on research on memory that sort of, talks about the importance of repetition in establishing memories, and in particular, sort of like spaced practice. Mm-hmm. So it's good to sort of, to learn something and then come back and try to learn it again at some time in the future, rather than to sort of like, cram a certain thing into your brain and then never look at it again and just assume that it's there and ready to come out whenever you need to. It's also really good to test yourself, because the process of testing actually causes learning. And this, in a way, is one reason why the process of playing chess actually causes chess improvement. Because playing chess, in a way, is sort of like a test. It sort of forces you to retrieve some of the information that you think you've stored. It could be as simple as like, sequences of opening moves that you thought you had memorized, but then when you actually have to, play them on the board, you will be really testing your retrieval. So retrieval practice, that's sort of like practicing retrieving information you've stored, spacing out, your study, testing yourself, is really important. And I guess, the idea also, I think, of there's some ideas sort of from areas like, behavioral economics as well that are important. So sort of like establishing, and I can't say that I'm like great at this myself. I'm probably pretty relatively low on the self-control department, but sort of like establishing, regimens that force yourself or get yourself in the habit of doing the studying. So one of the functions of actually just having a coach or taking lessons regularly is that it commits you to spending at least, like 1 hour, 1.5 hours a week, on chess studying. And it gives you sort of like an accountability mechanism, like especially if your coach gives you homework, well, at least you've got to do it sometime in the next 7 days. Right. And so on. So it's sort of like ways of structuring your practice to make sure that you do it. And some of those often seem like common sense in retrospect, but it's good to know that there's actually, scientific evidence in favor of all this stuff. And some of it is stuff that may seem like common sense, but people don't normally do. So like people don't normally test themselves as part of studying. Students in college notoriously will just, read the textbook and put a highlighter into it, but never actually sort of like see if they can, provide the answers until the time of the test comes around.
Yeah. And so some awesome advice packed in what you just said. And to highlight a couple points, spaced repetition, of course, is the technology behind Chessable, which I'm at least for the first time in 6 months, I'm considering playing in a chess tournament. So I've been messing around with Chessable a little bit. And yeah, it's so much more efficient than the stuff I grew up on. It's just shocking. And of course, I know there are other websites that are incorporating spaced repetition as well. And of course, when like for the Adult Improver series, when Stacia Pugh mentioned making flashcards, and we've had a few other people mention making flashcards as well, that's basically a low-tech version of doing the same thing. So definitely, some concrete advice there for listeners working hard on their chess. And similarly with routines, the guests we've had who've talked about how they approach, it's often like I wake up before the kids or, I make sure, like Lev Albert saying, make sure you have time where there's no distractions to study. So a lot of good advice. And are you working on your chess at all right now?
Well, I guess the outside world maybe should be the judge of, whether what I do actually counts as work. It's very sort of sporadic, and it often happens sort of like late at night while I'm not late at night, but in the evening, which is not the optimal time of day for sort of like mental arousal and focused attention and so on. But I have from your podcast and from other people's recent writings on chess and from like the kind of technology that's out there that you alluded to, I've heard of a really interesting idea, which I'm not really sure. I think it could have the potential to contribute to the science of learning more generally, which is people are often talking about actually repeating studying the exact same positions, right? So the woodpecker method, for example, which I read about in Axel Smith's book, and now they have a whole book, just about that, basically says like go through like 1,000 tactical positions and then go through the exact same positions again, which is really quite counterintuitive, because you would think it's much better to test your ability to find forks and skewers and deflections and so on in a new set of 1,000 positions, right? That would seem to sort of generalize your ability a bit more. But I think it could be an interesting hypothesis that actually retesting on the exact same material, which is examples of a broader theme, actually may be, you know, a beneficial or at least complementary method of learning sort of a general skill. And I haven't really seen that so much in the, you know, in the anything sort of comparing that to, you know, just doing more different positions on the same theme in sort of the learning literature. So I'm kind of thinking about that kind of stuff. I've sort of tried to, you know, write down my opening repertoire or put it into Chessable. I've been playing around with that, like you said, also, you know, doing tactics on the chess.com app, you know, when I can, playing a few blitz games here and there. You know, I sort of feel like I'm recovering some of my skill, but we'll see when I next time I play an actual tournament, I guess.
Do you have any plans of playing one?
I don't have any specific plans right now. I always have a vague plan, and I basically didn't play for about 18 years. 1995, I played in a tournament. I played in one in 1998, the amateur teams, and then I didn't play again until 2013 when my son got interested in chess. Not really because of me. He learned it in an after school program, and I decided to sort of try playing again because he was into it, and I was taking him to tournaments. So I played a little bit since then, a few tournaments a year. Actually my rating went up a little bit and then it went down and then I really sort of embarrassingly suffered, like, you know, a very bad tournament and then a horrible game where, no offense to the 1700 players out there, but I lost to a 1700 player, which I was not expecting to do as a 2260 player. You know, I sort of feel bad about this. I actually dropped out of the tournament and, you know, I sort of didn't want to play in any more tournaments.
we all know that feeling for sure.
I mean, I had a winning position and I just totally miscalculated a pawn ending of all things, you know, and it was one of those things where I just didn't consider the move that he played. It was like one of those thinking problems where you're not generating the candidate moves. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, people have written about that a lot, that sort of just generating the right candidate moves is an important, you know, is an important aspect of skill. And I don't know why I didn't do it, but I didn't. And it sort of affected me more than it should have.
Yeah, I've noticed that in my games. And I feel like one of the things that makes me weaker than people who are stronger than me is that it does happen more frequently that there are moves that I just don't consider. Have you come across any, like, research that, like, what would be the antidote to that?
I don't know. That's another really good question. I haven't thought of the answer before. Well, if I had the answer, I guess I wouldn't have this problem. But I haven't even really thought about the question that much. You know, one possible solution in chess might be to to use a structured thinking method whenever possible. Now, sometimes, you know, you're in time pressure or whatever, and you can't really do that. But you know, there are some structured thinking methods that sort of advise you to ask yourself, like, you know, three questions, you know, about the position, you know, things like, you know, what's the worst place piece, you know, and so on, who benefits from the trade of queens and questions like that. I'm not sure those would have solved this particular problem because this was sort of like a calculation and a pawn ending mm-hmm. problem. So it was really sort of like a classic blind spot or maybe sort of like the chess version of inattentional blindness. Like I was so focused on, you know, the line that I thought was forcing that I didn't, you know, sort of look at alternatives. But yeah, I feel like I'm disappointing you by being a cognitive psychologist, you know, on the program and not solving our thinking problems in chess, but I'll come back to, it's a hard game for a reason.
No, I mean, you've already given some amazing advice, so you don't owe me anything. So does your son still play chess?
Yeah, he does. He started out being really excited about it, as like most 5-year-olds are, I guess, when they learn chess. And he still plays. I mean, he plays a lot of soccer nowadays, so it's kind of hard to play as much chess as one might think would be optimal for, you know, now 10-year-old to improve. But, you know, he's still into it, and his interest sort of rises and rises and falls. And you know, sometimes when he plays in a tournament, he gets really interested, and then he wants to play in another one. But if we can't play in another one for a couple of weeks, then his interest sort of declines. So I've been trying to sort of apply a regimen of, you know, you have to play, you know, 2 rapid games a day and do, you know, tactics on chess.com each day so that when we get around to playing in a tournament again, hopefully he won't just sort of be, you know, rusty and then have a disappointing result. I'm sort of hoping to sort of maintain his interest until he decides whether he really wants to, you know, go more forward or go for something else.
That sounds reasonable. And what's your general philosophy about parenting? I mean, you know, apologies to listeners who don't have parents, but since it's come up, I can't help but ask. So like when a kid expresses an interest in a subject, how hard do you push it?
Well, hopefully all listeners have parents, or at least did at one point, but then
that's true. Good point. Yeah. I meant not kids, but anyway, you get the idea.
Well, I only have one child, so, and I'm no expert on parenting. But I did get some good advice from some of my friends who are teachers, who are chess teachers, you know, who have seen, you know, the interest levels and the enthusiasm and the pathways of, you know, hundreds of kids, you know, over the years. And, you know, it was, I believe it was David Goodman, who was the author of our Kasparov versus Deep Blue book, who's an international master chess teacher in New York City for many years, who said that, you know, the important thing is to sort of, you know, just, you know, maintain interest, sort of like don't let them give it up for a long period of time. It's kind of like, you know, if you stop doing your podcast for a month, it'll be harder to go back to doing.
Right. Yeah.
You know? So keep doing one a week, even if they're not like the best ones you've ever done or something like that. Likewise, I guess it would be sort of like keep playing in a chess tournament every so often and keep, you know, I don't know, following your favorite players. Like, you know, my son's a big Caruana fan and he's a fan of the U.S. team and the Olympiad and so on. So, you know, I sort of like, you know, pass him along news tidbits like that, trying to sort of like keep him, you know, keep him interested and try to play in a tournament every so often. And maybe at some point he'll have a couple of good tournaments in a row and he'll say, wow, I can really be good at this and I'll do more of it.
Well, that's cool that he has enough interest in chess, at least to have a favorite chess player and to follow the events. Cause I think that itself makes a difference in maintaining the interest of the younger generation.
He develops bizarrely strong opinions about things that he really doesn't know much about. So, you know, he'll, you know, I don't want to criticize any, I don't want to say any of the negative things he said about some chess players in particular. Right. He'll have some that he loves and some he thinks are horrible. And of course he has no basis for making these judgments.
Right. Well, that's age appropriate. If I could, exactly. if I could have back all the hours I spent arguing about sports when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's exactly the same kind of thing, except it's about chess players, which is even funnier.
Right. Okay. So what else do we have to talk about, Chris? I'm just scrolling through my outline. So you've got an interest in computers and chess, and you mentioned to me that you were a big fan of, you listened to my interview with Casa Corley, and you liked what he had to say about learning from computers.
Oh yeah. I mean, that whole interview was great. I mean, he said a lot of things that I've never heard anyone say before, and not that I pretend to know everything, but, you know, often, you know, people make similar comments and they have similar opinions, but he has said a lot of, you know, original and unique things. And one of them was he had a way of using computers in studying and learning that I never heard of before. And I believe I'm going to say this right. I think he said, you know, if you watch computer versus computer games, which a lot of people sort of denigrate and devalue and almost feel a disgust for, which surprises me, although it shouldn't surprise me, I guess, as a psychologist, but people really don't like computer games. But Casa Corley pointed out that if you look at the maneuvering that goes on when computers play each other, you can see how it's possible to sort of maintain a position or maintain an edge for a long period of time without actually, you know, taking a risk or without actually, you know, disturbing it. And in a way, that kind of reminded me of sort of the style that's sometimes attributed to players like Magnus Carlsen, and which, you know, Caruana seems to be assimilating a little bit more, you know, into his game, just from my sort of like amateurish observation of the talents of these guys, is, you know, the art of sort of like maneuvering and maintaining pressure and so on, and long-term, you know, looking for, you know, very long-term opportunities. And that's something that computers kind of do just because they're computers and they don't have any need to like force a resolution of the situation right quickly, and they don't get into time pressure, you know, and so on. So, you know, look at those AlphaZero games or, you know, Top Engine games. And that's really, like, I hadn't thought of that, but if you can actually sort of like look at, you know, what they do well, even though it seems kind of alien to us as humans, maybe there's some way we can try to, you know, learn from that for our own games.
Yeah. I mean, these things are rated 3400 for a reason. So
I posted, you mentioned those Facebook groups earlier. I posted more than once on Facebook, trying to instigate someone else to do this, and I've tried to instigate other specific people to do it and failed. Why doesn't someone produce a book of like the 50 best games of the chess engines and just like, you know, an annotated games of the chess engine? You know, there's so many books on Tal's games and so many books on Fischer's games and, you know, so many books on Kasparov's games and so on. There's not one book on the best games of the best chess players of all time.
Yeah. That's an excellent point.
Yeah, and people, there are some people who like understand how to use engines to analyze engine games and have some more insight into like sort of, you know, decision making by chess engines and so on. They could write that book and it would be great. I mean, and make videos out of it and, you know, whatever the current system is. Someone ought to write that book. And when I post, the funny thing is when I post that suggestion, you know, I get a lot of sort of like negative comments, like who would ever want to read that, or that would be boring, or, you know, no drama in that, and so on. So everybody's got their own opinion.
Yeah. Well, I have sort of the same reflexive reaction. Like it sort of, when you mention, and when Casa mentioned studying computer games, I have a sort of visceral repulsion. But like, you know, the old System 1 and System 2, when you think it through, it's like the benefit of it is obvious. So I think that there's just some natural impulse to resist it, but I don't, maybe people can get past that, because obviously, like you say, these are the best players of all time, these computers, so of course we could learn from them.
Yeah, I get that, and I sort of feel it too. Like if I examine myself, if I introspect myself, I don't find myself playing over engine games all the time. You know, there are some people who do, but I don't do it. Every so often, like, I will look at them. Like, I wrote a couple of columns for the Wall Street Journal about the Thoresen chess engines competition, which is now the top chess engines competition, I think. And so I looked at a few games for that, and I've looked at a few games, you know, since then, but I don't, like, habitually play over those games. I look at the games by the human players. So I kind of get that, but I think, you know, as you say, if you reflect on it, you know, there should be room for at least one book like that in the thousands and thousands of chess books that have been published in history.
Yeah, for sure. And the sooner the better, because I mean, these computers are, they're just so strong, and it's encouraging for the progress that humans can still make, that there have been huge breakthroughs in computers, and they're much stronger than humans, which shows just to catch up to them, there's a lot of room for improvement, let alone the fact that computers will probably continue to improve. So there's room beyond that.
That's a really interesting question, whether they will continue to improve. Like, I think some people think there might be sort of a ceiling around, you know, 3,700, maybe 4,000, something like that, in ELO terms. But who knows? We haven't got there yet.
Yeah, we haven't. Although that calls to mind the question, what's your opinion? Did you catch any of the Chess 960 event? And are you pro or anti Chess 960?
That's another thing I commented on Facebook that sort of seems to elicit disgust. Some people really hate Chess 960. And again, I can't say that I spend all my time playing it. I've actually tried to play it on chess.com sometimes. It seems kind of hard to get a game. If you just like do a challenge, an open challenge for Chess 960, at least the way I'm doing it, it seems harder to get an opponent than for, you know, regular chess, which makes sense. You know, that's what most people are interested in. I think my main thought was that it's extremely validating that the top players are doing it. Now, maybe they're getting paid to do it, but I think they actually find it interesting. And
yeah.
You know, if you just like look at the way they talk about it and those videos of them like sort of analyzing the openings before the round started and so on, I mean, I think they find it actually intriguing. And of course, you know, in a sense, chess is, quote, played out for them more than it is for, you know, us weaker players, because they're better at it. But still, once they start playing it more, I think it's going to become more popular. And why not? Like, we've been playing Bughouse since we were kids.
Right.
You know, like, that's okay. You know,
yeah.
Bughouse is okay. Why not 960?
Yeah, and I feel like this last tournament, it sort of seemed like it was maybe a breakthrough, because I did feel like the players were generally more effusive and enthusiastic than they had been previously. And one other thing to mention, I'll play you in Chess 960, because my opening theory is crap. All my openings are horribly outdated, and I still like playing, so we should set up a match sometime.
Okay, good. We'll do it.
All right, Chris, just a couple more topics for you, if you don't mind. Chess books, of course.
All you need to say is chess books, I guess.
Yeah, well, I know you mentioned even before we were recording that, of course, you were ready for the book recommendation question. So,
that's a great that's a great question, and I actually did prepare for this question a little bit, and I found it sort of difficult to. I went and looked at my bookshelves, and this is how I actually counted my books. I don't maintain a running count. I actually counted them because I knew I was going to be on, and I thought it'd be interesting to see how many I have. And I found it difficult a little bit to sort of separate out books that I spent a lot of time reading in the past, or that I feel were sort of inspirational to me being interested in chess and continuing to be interested in chess, versus books that are actually good for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give a few like random suggestions, I guess, of books. And also I'm trying to avoid the stuff that everybody else has already mentioned. So obviously every book by Nunn, every book by Dvoretsky, every book by Agard, every book by John Watson, every book by Kasparov, like we can all agree that those are all great. And, you know, if one can study them, you know, and even read them for enjoyment, you know, that's great. Well, which reminds me, I guess I should have said another thing about like learning science, you know, and so on. I'll just to sort of switch topics on you for 1 second. Some people on the podcast have made the point that it's really more important to do some chess thing that you enjoy doing than to try to force yourself to do a chess thing you don't enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's completely true, because there's no fighting motivation in the end, right? You have to have enough motivation to do something, or else it doesn't get done. And then activities that don't get done don't contribute to your improvement. So really, like, anything is better than nothing. It's kind of like any exercise regimen is better than just never exercising, right? So, you know, I'd go back to that too. So some books that may seem like they're not really targeted improvement books, reading them, studying them, you know, so on, is probably better for your chess than, you know, than not doing any chess. So some of the books that haven't been mentioned as much or at all that I thought might be worth mentioning. I guess I'll start with Chess Tactics for Advanced Players, which is a book by Yuri Averbakh.
Yeah, good book. Yeah, I have.
So you know it. So that's great. I mean, it's kind of like a little bit of an old school book. I don't think it's been reprinted really for a long time. Chess Digest reprinted it in like the early 90s, I think. It's a book from, I think, from the 70s, that was published in English maybe in the 80s and then reprinted in the early 90s. And it's kind of, it's a really interesting book. It kind of foreshadows a bit some of the more sort of systematic approaches to chess tactics that have come out in recent books. Like there's this recent book by called Chess Tactics from Scratch, which I think some people have mentioned. This is, in a way, the forerunner of that. It sort of has like a theory of tactics, sort of like all tactics are based on double attacks or combinations, and he sort of tries to define what those things are and what the difference is. And he uses a lot of studies as examples to sort of show, you know, properties of the pieces and the way the pieces can interact. But it goes all the way up to complete games, and some of them are sort of classic complete games, like from Steinitz and, you know, and Anderson, even that far back to more recent stuff. It kind of stops sort of like in the 70s. Like, I think the, you know, there are no Kasparov games in it, for example. I think there's maybe a couple of Karpov games is as far as it gets. But it's really interesting and you know, another way to, you know, to study that that topic. Positional Decision Making in Chess by Gelfand, which just came out a couple of years ago, really deserves, you know, more mention. That is an absolutely superb book. He actually honestly says, you know, what he saw and what he didn't see and why you don't need to see maybe as much during the game as you think that grandmasters see. It's incredibly well written. You know, he really talks a lot about sort of his own thoughts during his own games, which is rare. Because there's sort of an incentive, you know, after the game to make it seem as though you've seen it all. And there's sort of like a tradition in chess writing almost of sort of writing these super authoritative annotations, but not distinguishing between what you saw during the game and what you figured out afterwards. Let's see. I'll just keep going for a couple minutes and then stop.
Didn't you mention in an email to me the Kislik book?
Yeah. So Eric Kislik's new book, Applying Logic in Chess. Eric's a really interesting guy. He's an IM, but he sort of learned. He really didn't start playing tournaments until, I don't know exactly what age, but maybe high school or even later. And yet he became an IM relatively quickly. So I think anything he has to say about sort of his recommendations for studying and training and so on is probably worthwhile just on that basis. But he has also thought a lot about, you know, what are good methods. And some of his opinions are controversial, and his book is a bit controversial. But there's a lot of great material in it about learning and studying. And, you know, he goes over sort of like, you know, questions to ask yourself, you know, during the game, and also like sort of a structured way for analyzing your own games. Like, what questions should you ask yourself about your own games after they're over? How would you organize like studying your own games if you didn't have a coach, or even before you talk to your coach or your teacher or something like that? That's a great book.
Just wanted to throw in, he was just on Cover Stories with Chess Life, Dan Lucas's podcast that he came on and discussed, and I found him very compelling. So if you or any listeners have not heard him on that, it just came out earlier this week, or what it'll be last week when this comes out. Anyway, you guys should check that out and check out the article he wrote in the October Chess Life.
Yeah, that's great stuff. So another great book that came out this year is called Under the Surface, which has kind of gone under the radar, but it's from Quality Chess, and it's by this grandmaster named Jan Marcos. I hadn't heard of him before, but it's basically all kinds of short chapters with sort of like novel ideas about, you know, about chess. It's just sort of like a different way of thinking about things. It's always good to sort of see, you know, different ways of understanding the same, you know, the same concepts. An older book that I think people have mentioned that I would also plug is Masters of the Chessboard by Reddy.
Yeah, classic.
It's sort of one of those underappreciated classics. You know, it's not reprinted very much, you know, unlike, let's say, the Capablanca books or maybe Lasker books or Alekhine books and so on. There's a clever book by Charles Hertan, who's a FIDE master from Massachusetts that I used to sort of play from time to time when I lived up there, called Forcing Chess Moves, which is basically sort of, you know, some suggestions for how to calculate by looking at forcing moves first, basically doing what computers do, you know, sort of exploring more candidate moves and sort of how to figure out what candidate moves to look at. That's a really nice one. Let's see, there's a Chess Structures by Mauricio Flores, which came out a few years ago from Quality Chess. Also great. It sort of goes over like all the different pawn structures from different kinds of openings and employs sort of like a nice technique, which is used more and more in successful books. I think maybe John Nunn originated it, or maybe others did, where like he'll go through a game that meant to illustrate some points. And then at the end of the game, he'll summarize the points. Mm-hmm. Like he'll actually tell you, like, here are the four lessons to learn from this game, or the four points you can pick up or whatever, which is kind of like standard good pedagogy. It's like college professors finishing the class with sort of like a reminder slide about here's what we learned today and here's why it matters. But you don't see it often in, you know, in chess books and so on. So that's great. And I'd still put in a plug for Zurich 1953, which is a very controversial book also. A lot of people seem to not like it, but some of the best players in the world say it was like their favorite book ever. And when I was turned on to it, it seemed like a revelation to me at the time. It's a tournament narrative with drama, but it's also like a textbook. Like there's a lot of detailed discussion of different kinds of positions and, you know, and so on in there. And whoever actually wrote it, you know, it's still great. I think the Bronstein, the version that's attributed to Bronstein, that's the one I'm thinking of.
It's like you say, it is a bit of a lightning rod, but certainly no shortage of guests have recommended it here. And it had a similar impact on me. It's one that I read as a teenager and loved.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. There's a few that haven't been. I'll throw in one more. Sorry to drag you on too long, but there's a book that nobody knows anymore called How to Play the Endgame in Chess by Leonard Barden, and it's from the 1970s, and it's basically just sort of like an introduction to endgames. It's probably still pretty valid, and I had to reacquire it because I'd gotten rid of my copy, as with many of my books. And it's the first play. I think Barden is the guy who coined the term Fischer endgame. So there have been articles since then on the so-called Fischer endgame, which is rook and bishop versus rook and knight with pawns on both sides of the board in a fairly, you know, with a lot of pawns and pawns on both sides of the board. And Fischer won a number of games like that. I think famous one against Taimanov in the candidates matches or something, you know, which sort of seem equal, but Fischer sort of showed the technique for winning those kind of things. And I think Barden was the first guy who pointed that, and he has a whole chapter on it in that book. It goes from sort of like, you know, king and pawn versus king all the way up to that kind of stuff. And it's probably better than its non-existent reputation.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. That's a good one. That's a deep cut.
That's a deep cut. Exactly. Yeah. I have other deep cuts, but they might be even too deep or too, you know, or too obscure. So we could, you know, I could go on and on about this, but probably. Well,
maybe we can save it for another visit, but I'm impressed with, I knew that obviously you well-read chess fan, but that you're keeping up with the literature, that a lot of your recommendations are just from the last few years.
It's kind of, I mean, it's nice of you to say I'm keeping up with literature. It could be that I have some kind of compulsion or that I, you know, that I don't allocate my spending money properly or something like that. But whatever the cause is, the result is that I do seem to know a lot about what's getting published.
I mean, considering that, you know, you've got a successful career and you're a parent, I mean, it's worthy of praise. Okay, so one other quick topic to touch on, and apologies to anyone who you know, doesn't want to hear about poker. This is a chess podcast, so we don't talk about it too much. But I know that you and I have emailed a little bit. I know we have a shared interest in that topic. So just out of curiosity, how did you get into that, and what's going on with that?
Well,
like, do you play much?
I sort of play. I used to play a lot when, you know, when online poker was, I don't want to say legal, but when it was, you know, when it was in its heyday,
right.
I used to play a lot more than I do now. On the other hand, nowadays I have, you know, I feel like I earn enough money that I can afford to go play in some World Series of Poker events each year. So I'm kind of one of those once a year guys who plays in a bunch of tournaments once a year and maybe then like a couple others, like a couple other little tournaments here and there. And, you know, play some cash games occasionally, you know, when I'm out in Las Vegas for that, or, sometimes at a conference or something, like after the last day of a conference, I've been known to go to the local casino and play. And, you know, kind of boring the way I get into that, but, you know, some of my friends like saw the 2003 World Series of Poker on TV and they got into it and, you know, they said, hey, you should watch this and so on. I got into it. And it, of course, one thing I noticed was like how like a lot of chess players got into it, and chess players seem to have been at least anecdotally fairly successful in poker. And I've often thought about why that is. And I think it might be sort of for the mundane reason that chess players are used to sort of sitting still and thinking about one thing for a long period of time, which is not necessarily sort of the mentality you would normally attribute to a gambler.
Right. Yeah. That's so a good point.
If you have the opportunity to take people who are used to like thinking deeply about something and, you know, and concentrating over an extended period of time and putting them up against people who typically are people who like to gamble, the chess players might have a bit of an edge.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially the stereotypical, like, in the pit, standing, yelling, gambler.
Yeah, exactly, which, that's why you want the poker room to always be, like, near the rest of the games in the casino, because, like, that atmosphere and attitude sort of will spill over a little bit into the poker room, or at least people will be able to come from the roulette table with their winnings and put it right down on the poker table, and then, you know, maybe be at a little bit of a disadvantage.
Yeah, to put it mildly. Cool. Well, thank you so much. This was an awesome talk. Is there anything chess related that you were hoping I would bring up that we haven't covered? I mean, we didn't cover the World Championship and the Olympiad, but I mean, you know, the Olympiad will, first of all, it's like a tense moment in the Olympiad when we're recording, and it'll be over when it comes out. And the World Championship, I'm excited. It sounds like your son's excited, but I don't know if there's anything new we could say. What do you think?
I'll tell you my one story. Sometimes you ask people for stories. I'll tell you my one story about the World Championship. I've been to a few World Championship matches just as a spectator occasionally, and I'm planning to go to London.
Oh, awesome.
With my son for a few games. I may be one of the only players, you know, outside of the world elite who has played with Caruana and Carlsen at the same time. And the way that I did that was the Liberty Science Center in New Jersey. Paul Hoffman organized an event there where Magnus Carlsen appeared and Fabiano Caruana appeared. And at the time I was writing a column for the Wall Street Journal on games. It was sort of like a monthly column that I wrote for about 3 years. And so their PR firm, or maybe Paul himself, you know, reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to cover this event? We're going to have Caruana and Carlsen there, and we're going to organize a tandem blitz game, and you might be able to be one of the players. And I said, sure, I would consider covering that. I can't make any promises, but I'll do my best. And I showed up, and I was supposed to be paired with, you know, on the team with one of those two, and then was going to be someone else. I think it was going to be a potential donor or something like that was going to be one of the other, you know, paired with the other player. And he didn't show up. So Denari Braxton, who's a filmmaker, like a 2200 player.
Yeah, I know him.
You know, cool guy. He stepped in. And I think Paul asked me, like, who do you want to be your partner? And I said, I would like, you know, I would like Fabiano to be my partner because he's, you know, he was my favorite player. But then I could say that, like, I played against Magnus Carlsen, which would kind of be cool.
Right.
I was a little worried that if I played with Magnus Carlsen on his same team and that I screwed up the game, that would be even more embarrassing if I was the one who lost it for us. So, you know, tandem, as in case it's not clear what I'm referring to, tandem is where you have two players on a team, but one board, and the players just alternate moves. So, you know, so in this game, I think like Magnus made the first move and then Fabiano made the second move and then.
Yeah, and no communication allowed between the teammates.
Well, yes. And in theory, no communication is allowed, but, you know, part of the delight of tandem chess is seeing how close you can come to right. Over that line by like your facial expressions or by your body language or by seeming to emit sounds, which, you know, might be suggestive of something. and or by, you know, also by telling your partner to press the clock if they forget to press the clock and so on, because the person who makes the move is supposed to press the clock, just like in regular chess. So we played one game, and I've been meaning to write about this somewhere, but I haven't really gotten around to doing it. But we managed to survive into a rook and pawn endgame, which was a theoretical draw. And then I made a really stupid move, and Fabiana resigned the next move.
just to drive the point home. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there was like an increment. Maybe there was like a 2 second increment. I don't remember the exact time control, but they still would have had to win because they had like 4 seconds left and we had 10. So there was always a chance that like they would, you know, that the flag would fall and it would be a draw or something like that. But I think he felt honor bound to resign this totally losing position.
Huh, that's an amazing story and must have been a fun experience.
So it's funny that was a year. Then a year later, I went to the Carlsen Karjakin match with my son just to watch a game, you know, to hang out and so on. And of all things, Caruana was there also just hanging out. Like he showed up and he was signing some autographs and so on. And it's so funny, like the next challenger, like sort of showing up to the previous match just as like as making an appearance or whatever. Don't think we really saw that too much in the past. So I went up to him to get an autograph, introduced myself. And I said, I'm the guy who screwed up that rook and pawn endgame in the tandem game. And he's like, oh yeah. Oh yeah. I remember that now.
And then he could probably play through the whole game.
Yeah. So I sort of thought for a while, I hope this doesn't psychologically undermine him somehow that I forced him to resign a game against Magnus Carlsen, you know, but it seems like he's doing just fine. You know?
Yeah. My goodness. He's having quite an Olympiad. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. So. Okay. Well, we'll have fun in London. And if anyone wants to reach you, like I said, you're active in the Facebook Chess Book Collectors group and you're on Twitter. What's the best way to reach you?
Some of my chess stuff is on my website, which is chabris.com, chabris.com. And there's some links on that page to like the old American Chess Journal issues and to the books that I talked about. And some other old columns that I published. And then on Twitter, I'm at CF Chabris. And those are probably the best places to find anything that I'm up to.
Okay, excellent. Well, good luck with your research and your chess and your travels and everything else.
All right, well, thanks a lot. It was really fun to be on this podcast and keep up the great work. I listen to this every week when it comes out, and I'm glad you're doing it.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music, Matthew Passy, my esteemed producer, and everyone who's written a good review on Apple Podcasts or other podcast platforms or told a friend about the show. Every little bit helps. But of course, I'm most indebted to those who donate to support the show. Without you guys, the show would not be possible. And I want to give special thanks to my Patreon and PayPal Perpetual partners. Here are your names. I'm slowly but surely correcting some mispronunciations, so let's see how I do this time. Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Brancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Ali Morchetti, Andres Quizdois, Brian Mullis, Carl LeBons, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Chabris, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zielicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel D. Schaefer, Daniel Vine-E, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Agard, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Leo Delgado, Lorraine Dore, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson of the Full English Breakfast, Matthew Tedesco, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, Pascal Charbonneau, Paul Swaney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, Ryan Stone, Steiner Lima, Stuart Katz, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancouge, Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, everyone. Catch you guys soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.